This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 27 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Hi, David. We're seeing some really good discussion in the episode 24 comments concerning a proposal for the classification, licensing, and permitting of UAS. And we'll touch on that a little bit later. But we've also got another great lineup of topics to discuss. What can we look forward to this episode?
Well, our ubiquitous DJI Phantom has been watching baseball spring training. Can the FAA police UAS usage? And this is going to be a weekly topic, I think. Canada wants to buy drones for search and rescue. Russian military wants to buy drones and can't get enough of them. And Korea seeks to be a UAS supplier for UAVs that fly one mission and one mission only. So that'll be a unique topic to talk about. Pitchers and catchers have reported, so I guess we should get started. Well, the Nationals, Washington, D.C.'s baseball team, formerly known as the Expos, according to CBSSports.com, has been using a drone to record footage of spring training. They're using a GoPro mounted on a DJI Phantom. If I had was a betting man, I would have said that that would be the pair that it would be.
It seems to show up all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be the ubiquitous pair. They also said they want to use the footage for scoreboards and games. We had the Olympics last week talking about UAVs, and now they're crawling into our national pastime.
Yeah, they sure are. Now, just from a standpoint of building the team and doing the training, I would think that the perspective that could be offered by a Phantom flying around with a GoPro could be pretty valuable to a team. I mean, you could really get in there and look at plays and examine, critique them. I think as a training aid, it sounds like a really, really good application. What do you think?
No, I think it's a really good application, but is it legal?
Yeah, you know, see, it's so confusing, isn't it? If they just limit it to that, okay, so it's flying in a controlled environment, it's not out in the public. Obviously, a baseball team is a commercial operation. They're using it in the development of the team capabilities, but they're not selling a UAS service to anybody. I mean, it seems fairly benign. They're looking to go beyond that, as the article mentions, and use some of the footage, as you mentioned, David, up on the scoreboard during games. Now, it wasn't really clear to me if they meant live coverage or coverage from that game, or if they were just going to use some of the clips that they had produced as part of the spring training. I'm not sure. But it certainly points to a UAV being really heavily involved in the operation of this baseball team. And frankly, I don't know what the FAA would say about that. I don't know if they'd say it's good, bad, or indifferent.
The Nationals run the presidents around the bases. I'm looking forward to, you know, in the seventh inning stretch, we'll have DJI Phantoms doing drone races for the entertainment, or better yet, have them deliver hot dogs, kind of like the cannons that shoot the hot dogs. So there's a lot of things that we could talk about for baseball and UAVs, but I get the impression, though, that the footage they're using is going to be part of their scoreboard footage when someone's coming up to bat or something like that. I don't see them yet putting a DJI Phantom over the game as it's being played, because God forbid it falls out of the sky and prevents a home run or something, or worse, lands on one of the players. So it'll be interesting to watch. It's early in the season and in spring training, so we'll see if other teams pick up the mantle, excuse the pun, as in Mickey, and go for it is a learning tool. Personally, being a Phillies fan, it's kind of frightening that my beloved Phillies are falling behind on the curve when it comes to UAV training. But I guess we should move on to talking about the FAA, and the FAA is trying to do something, which we talk about every week. So you want to take the next story?
Yeah, this is a piece in Bloomberg, which is, I find this a really interesting article. The title is Runaway Drones Map Land, Film Wolf, Knock Down People as FAA Gives Chase. Well, as we know, the FAA takes a dim view of UAVs and has notified many operators to cease operations. Now, sometimes people, I think, are ignorant of the FAA policy. They just don't know. Other times they are aware of it, I think, but choose to ignore it or try to stay under the radar. And some others even believe that what they're doing is allowable and not in violation of any FAA policy. But the question is it even possible for the FAA to police the use of UAVs? Now, we see a number of applications. We talk about them every week. We just talked about a baseball team. We've seen movie productions use UAVs. We've seen delivery services, including things like a beer and flowers. And we've even seen, and the article points out, this is an interesting case where PBS, Public Broadcasting Service, aired a documentary about the U.S. Civil War battle at Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. And that included footage shot by a Firefly. Now, interesting, the producers asked the U.S. National Park Service for permission before they used that in this production. And they said, okay, but what the Park Service didn't realize, and I guess nobody did, is that really you have to check with the FAA about aviation regulations. So we see all these applications, and people are chomping at the bit to utilize UAVs. And so back to the question, is this really anything that the FAA can control? What do you think, David?
I don't know. It's kind of hard to enforce rules that you don't even know what the rules are, is really what it boils down to. And you know, when your other federal agencies like the National Park Service don't even know what your rules are, clearly there's an issue. The cat is definitely out of the bag, and where Pandora's box is open, how you want to do the analogy. And the FAA is going, but no. But instead of focusing on getting the rules down so they can enforce them, they're trying to enforce something that isn't enforceable, because there really isn't any. The answer is no. So if they're going to enforce it, they need to enforce it everything. And they're sort of being selective on, I guess, maybe they're trying to find the perfect example.
Or maybe they just don't have the visibility into all the applications out there. I mean, we've run into situations, David, where we've seen something in the newspaper that looked like an interesting application. We go to contact that individual to see if we can get some more information or even get them to be on the show. And you get sometimes, or oftentimes, radio silence. I think people, you know, get out there, they get known, they get in the press, the FAA takes a look and can see that and then says, "Not, you can't do that." And so that's the end of that. But the article had an interesting statistic, because I had been wondering how many times has the FAA issued basically a cease and desist letter to someone using a UAV. And the article says that in the 13 months ending July 2013, so it's not horribly recent, but in those 13 months, the FAA conducted 17 enforcement actions for illegal use. And we know one of those included a fine, a $10,000 fine, which is being contested. The article mentioned 13 isn't a whole lot. That's a lot lower than I would have thought. But the article mentions that doesn't include informal steps taken, like phone calls and that kind of thing, which doesn't find its way into the formal statistics, I guess. So, I mean, it doesn't sound like a huge number. I mean, we must have hundreds and hundreds of people doing things out there that if the FAA could see every one of those things, they would be a little upset.
But we also know the FAA doesn't have the built-in bureaucracy or infrastructure to do all of this yet. So 17 enforcement actions, I don't know how many people the FAA, and we really need to get the FAA on, how many people they actually have on their UAV enforcement dragnet program. It's sort of, you know, 17 enforcement actions, and what's the bureaucracy involved with making one of those enforcement actions? I mean, is it a couple of phone calls and then a letter? We don't even know what the escalation process is. We just know that there's been one fine, and that's the example held out as what's going to happen to you if you continue to do this. But there's a lot of gray area here, and again, it boils down to you can't enforce what you don't know what you're enforcing. So I guess we'll move on to other things, because I'm sure we'll talk about the FAA for another 20 minutes next week. But let's talk about UAVs dropping things other than bombs. Canada's looking for a UAV to act as a SAR aircraft. SAR stands for Search and Rescue. Canada's got a very large landmass with not a lot of people in it, kind of like our friends down under. And they want to use drones like they use P-3s and various other aircraft for search and rescue in the wilderness. And they'd love the UAVs to have the ability to, say, drop a life raft if they're over the water, or maybe just bomb some meals ready to eat for someone who's surviving out in the wilderness in a blanket. So they're looking at a serious rescue UAV, and we've got a lot of competitors for these. The Heron, the Reaper, or the Predator B, if you're talking civilian terms, and the Hermes 900, all going to compete for this Arctic mission.
Yeah, and they're looking to spend somewhere between 1 billion Canadian and 1.5 billion on a fleet. So it's a serious commitment. And I think that in some cases, as you mentioned, David, they're looking to replace sort of existing manned aircraft with UAVs, which can help make them more cost effective, I would think, and offer some other advantages as well. Between those three that were mentioned under consideration, the Heron, the Reaper, and the Hermes 900, I don't know if they are leaning towards one or the other in terms of capability, and I'm not sure what the timeline is for the assessment and decision and acquisition of these. I don't know if you've seen anything, David.
No, but you are talking about medium male aircraft, medium altitude, long endurance. So you want to be able to put an aircraft up and have it stay up for a day looking for people or whatever. And all three of these are very capable aircraft. The disadvantage, and this came a lot of this came out of the Singapore Air Show, is General Atomics is sort of starting to whine that their hands are tied, that they can only sell their aircraft, being the Predator and the Reaper, to specific nations that the U.S. military allows. Whereas IAI, or Israeli Aerospace Industries, or Ebit Systems, for the Hermes or the Heron, they can sell to whoever they want. So the General Atomics is kind of saying, we're losing out here, folks, for international missions. So it'll be interesting to see who racks in the benefits. I don't see I have any problem with General Atomics being able to market the Predator B for the maritime surveillance. In fact, the Predator B, or the Reaper, is actually used by Customs and Border Patrol as a naval surveillance aircraft. But I do like the idea that there'll be a lot of people very angry when drones start coming to the rescue and saving people instead of blowing up people. I mean, and you know what? If we're really lucky, they'll select the Predator the Reaper, because that way the media can pick one, though it won't be a rescue Reaper. It'll be equipped with the usual 2,000-pound bombs and Hellfires, which will be an interesting caption about a Reaper saving someone fully equipped with its weapon system. So I look forward to that. And let's talk about 9 billion rubles.
Hmm.
or 320 billion rubles or 9 billion US for the Russian military defense systems.
The Russians are looking to expand their drones. They have around 500 that they operate now, and they are looking to spend a lot of money and increase that fleet by 2020 for a lot more. The article points out, this is an article in Defense News, that Russian President Vladimir Putin is a big supporter of UAVs, and he believes Russia needs to develop combat and reconnaissance variants. And so the Russians are looking to greatly expand and purchase. I guess they're looking more outward than indigenously developed drones.
Well, I think their indigenous programs currently, like the SKAT or the SCAT by the Mikoyan company, have not been really quantum leaps. Actually, it looks like the Chinese have a huge quantum leap over the Russians as far as UAVs go. So I have a feeling it's sort of a let's go out and see if we can play catch up by acquiring external people like IAI, and acquire the technology that way so that you can start making indigenous ones, because their current one has not been. Their current programs have not necessarily been as successful as the Israelis, the United States, and including China, though China can be dubious on, yes, they have a lot of aircraft UAVs flying, but really, what are their capabilities? You know, they might be just, there might be no there. They can fly a UAV, which is a giant radio-controlled airplane. And as far as technology goes, as far as their underneath goes, it might not be there. So Russia's definitely fallen behind and needs to catch up.
Now, the article mentions that they were scheduled to test some ADCOM systems, United 40 medium altitude, long endurance UAVs. We found another article in Jane's that says that while the testing was to begin in February of this year, 2014, it's been postponed for I'm not sure what reasons. That's another one under consideration. And of course, as you mentioned, they have purchased UAVs from IAI in the past.
Yeah, and the United Block 40 we've talked about in the past because it's probably one of the ugliest airplanes we've ever seen. You can check it out on the link in the show notes. But it is kind of interesting if you think about it from a military aviation perspective that Russia is going to the United Arab Emirates to purchase military hardware. Usually it's the Gulf states that are reaching out to all the other countries to buy all the hardware. In this case, it's kind of reverse, and it does illustrate where Russia is with their UAVs.
Right. Now, we also saw in Jane's an article concerning the Singapore Air Show that was just concluded, and the Koreans also have dreams of a military UAV, don't they?
Yeah, this is going back to the days of UAVs in the United States and in the 20s and post-World War One, where you've got flying bombs. The Devil Killer UAV is a maritime weapon. Basically, what they want to do is fly the drone out, let it orbit over the enemy ships, and at necessary, then basically fall on it and blow it up. It's a tactical suicide combat UAV, which it's a cruise missile. A drone by any other name is a cruise missile. It's interesting that they're marketing it as a UAV instead of a cruise missile, basically because you can loiter it and at any time drop it on. When you cruise missile, you have a limited amount of time. So it's putting a spin on the cruise missile, which is pretty much a drone and it's autonomous, but this is not the way to promote peaceful UAVs is having them drop on other ships.
Yeah, for sure. This comes from Korea Aerospace Industries. And I guess the idea is that this thing carries a payload, a 2-kilogram payload. And the idea is, yeah, that's detonated when the UAV is flown into the target by an operator, by a remote operator. So they're pitching it. They don't have any buyers for it yet, and they haven't started production of it yet. They would, I guess, if they were able to get a buyer. And we'll watch and see how they make out with this. I'm sure they're pretty serious about entering the market and providing this kind of vehicle, and we'll see how they do. You know, it's kind of an interesting time because a lot of different countries see the potential for sales, maybe especially military applications, but not exclusively. And so we see a lot of countries one way or another trying to develop their own capability to build, market, and sell these kinds of things. Some have been more successful than others. The Israelis, of course, are an example of a success story. But the Koreans are trying as well.
So, this is a to-be-continued story. But last week, Max, we came up with a new segment, and I basically called it with the unique name of Video of the Week. So I got to pick last week's Niagara Falls video, and if you folks haven't checked it out, you really do need to. But how about your pick this week, Max?
Yeah, it was easy because one of our listeners helped me out with this. This was from Colin Sweetman in the UK, and he sent along a link to a video that's titled Building Tensile Structures with Flying Machines. Well, what does that mean? Well, what this video shows is first one quadcopter that has a spool of a cable or rope underneath it and a framework, a metal framework, let's say. And this thing can fly around and unspool the rope to create kind of a net, kind of a structure based on this this cabling. It's just kind of an amazing thing. It sort of reminds me of a spider building a web and kind of, you know, moving around in different directions, trailing the web behind it. That's what this quadcopter does. But then it gets even better, and the video shows an example of where two quadcopters operating at the same time can unspool this material and build shapes together based on their flying patterns and sort of interweaving the rope. Certainly, I think it's a demonstration of some amazing control of these quadcopters. And so that's our video of the week, and we want to thank Colin for sending the link in to us.
So remember, folks, we are desperately looking for the video of the week. So don't forget to send us, if you see something or you've recorded something, send it to feedback@theuavdigest.com, and we'll pick the best one and we'll put it on the show notes so everyone can see it. And speaking of feedback, let's get back to going back three episodes now, episode 24, UAV licensing and permitting proposal. And we've got more from Tim on the feedback, and he's really taking to heart the constructive feedback that's been being provided.
Yeah, there have been a lot of good comments, some interesting thoughts from the listeners, and all that can be found on that, on the comments for that episode. If you want to get to it really quickly, you can use the shortcut theuavdigest.com/24 for episode 24. Take a look at those comments and add your contributions. If you feel a little intimidated about sort of the number of issues that might be raised, well, then just pick one maybe and give your feedback and thoughts on that. Tim sent along a little description that I think is very interesting. He talks about the FAA's current approach to the UAV revolution, and it is a revolution, he says. It's like catching the tiger by the tail, and the FAA only plans to catch up with the tiger in a few years or so, he says. And Tim wrote up a very interesting piece that we'll include in the show notes for this episode. But Tim does have some interesting thoughts to add to the conversation. He said that in a recent survey, it found that some people claimed that they didn't know anything about the FAA's position, and others who were unconcerned or even defiant. Some of those enjoying, quote, unregulated hobby use of UAVs brag about how high and far they can fly, clearly outside of the FAA's recommendation for visual line of sight under 400 feet. Tim says airline and helicopter pilots continue to express serious safety concerns, while comments on the other side tend to minimize any real dangers in the unlikely event of an encounter between a UAV and a commercial aircraft, even in the face of reports of several close calls reported by pilots. None of this will improve with time. In the meantime, don't look for any mention of the FAA anywhere on websites of the manufacturers or companies selling UAVs. And this is an interesting point, that those selling these vehicles, like DJI and all the others, really are silent when it comes to informing their customers about what the FAA may consider to be allowable or not. So he has some thoughts on that as well.
Well, in all fairness, it's no different than an automobile company giving you a car and saying, you can drive 200 miles an hour, and with no mention of the fact that the speed limit's 65. You know, so, and it's not our fault that you did. So, it goes back to, we really need a policing standard for us, the UAV industry, to take charge of this and stop waiting around for the FAA to do something.
Yeah, because they're not really constituted as a policing organization, which some people might find surprising, since the FAA, of course, has got more regulations than, you know, you can possibly imagine, thousands of pages of regulations. And so don't they have to make sure that everybody complies with them? And of course, the answer is yes, they do need to ensure that everyone complies with them. But the process for doing that is not based on an army of FAA inspectors or officials who monitor what people are doing. There are a lot of systems and processes out there that are managed by other people, the OEMs, the airlines, and others. And it's sort of a self-policing, in many ways, kind of function that's overall regulated by the FAA.
Now you know the difference between a policing body and a governing body.
Right, right.
The FAA makes the rules. They don't necessarily enforce the rules. And aviation is pretty much a self-regulating industry. I mean, the FAA sets the guidelines, but it's the airlines that follow them. They go along with it. The FAA hasn't really ever had to be in a place where they've said, you have to do this. And usually they come up with the rules and everybody sort of follows them. So they really aren't, like you said, aren't set up to enforce the regulations they need to start enforcing. You know, unfortunately, it's going to take several $10,000 fines before people start wising up.
Well, Tim's recommendation, his proposal, is that the FAA should, he says, immediately provide for a limited interim registration for all UAVs, defining the 400-foot stipulation, cautions against flying over people, and so on. He says the FAA should also provide the guidelines to retailers selling to U.S. citizens, requesting that the guidelines be included on retailer websites and distributed by the UAV community. So really interesting thoughts. Again, we'll put a lot of this in the show notes, and so check that out and contribute your thoughts to the conversation.
Well, Max, I think we've maxed out our show. You know, I think maybe we should come up with the UAV drinking game. The UAV drinking game being, you must do a shot every time we mention the word FAA.
Right.
But don't operate your drones after you've done the UAV drinking game.
That's right.
So definitely give us feedback. Keep the conversation going about Tim's proposals. And of course, we want to hear about your video of the week and basically suggestions for articles. And Max and I would love suggestions for guests. If you know somebody that you think would make a good guest, definitely send them our way so we can have some more interaction. And you can send all of that information to feedback@theuavdigest.com.
That's right. So thank you for listening. This has been episode 27 of the UAV Digest. Find full show notes at theuavdigest.com or use the shortcut, theuavdigest.com/27. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest and also same on Facebook, UAV Digest.
And don't forget, if you listen to us on iTunes, leave us a review so we can get more people out there. But most of all, have a good week. We'll see you next week. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.